Our scripture reading this morning comes to us from the New Testament, the fifth chapter of Matthew, verses 38 through 41. And these words tell us, "You have learned that they were told, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But what I tell you is this, do not set yourself against the man who wrongs you. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn and offer him your left. If a man wants to sue you for your shirt, let him have your coat as well. If a man in authority makes you go 1 mile, go with him too. Give when you are asked to give, and do not turn back on a man who wants to borrow." Now may these words find a place in our hearts, and may we better understand them before this hour has ended.
I think when we come to a lesson like today on non-resistance, it's a very important lesson. I've saved it to last because I think that there were other things we must learn in this series of this month. And I find that the author thought evidently it was a very important lesson because she saved it to the last chapter of the book entitled, "What Are You?" that we've been studying this last month. Now, sometimes when we come to an idea like non-resistance, we have to remember that it's a very foreign idea to our culture. We are Occidentals. We're Westerners. We're tremendously oriented to the outer. And yet, we are one of the great and growing parts of the church that has taken up again the original idea of first century Christianity, where we are what might be called modern day mystics. We are not orthodox. We believe that life is an inside job. And we believe that the only reality that can be found is the reality that we find that we are. And we find that as we find that we are-ness, in other words, our central identity, we find God. Because we are an extension of reality. Now the book makes a distinction in who we are and what we are. Most of us are in the consciousness of the who we are. That is the outwardly oriented awareness. We say, "Who are you?" And we start saying who we are, and what we own, what we have. But really, the question we all want to be able to answer is what we are. And of course, what we are contains the potential. Now, every morning when you come in here, you find written on the first page of the program, as it has been lately, the daily word lesson for today. And I think there's great power in this daily word lesson because it's been translated into many, many languages. And millions of people, not only in the United States, but all over the world, read it. So there is power in this collective consciousness. And I hope when you come into the sanctuary, rather than talk to your neighbor or think about other things, that you'll meditate upon this message. At the top of the page, the affirmative thought reads, "I am filled with peace and strength and the will to make a new beginning." And as I've said, we're talking about a subject and thinking about it this morning that is very foreign to most of us. I am filled with peace and strength and the will to make a new beginning. Let's say that together. I am filled with peace and strength and the will to make a new beginning. Wonderful. Let's say it again. I am filled with peace and strength and the will to make a new beginning. I think you're doing wonderful because you're maybe cracking the thought barrier within yourself. Let's say this quietly now and listen to ourselves as we say it together. I am filled with peace and strength and the will to make a new beginning. Now, even softer together. I am filled with peace and strength and the will to make a new beginning. Now, if you will, close your eyes. And shut out all of the form world. And go within yourself back to that place where you are formless, back of the self-image, back of that which you think you must be to be. Find that part of yourself that is an identity, but find that place within you where you are non-material and you are not a part of any material thing, not even the body. That place where you have the courage to release ownership of all things. That place where you do not need an ego to protect you or promote you. Where you can feel the oneness with all life. And in that oneness, you find new strength. You merge into a relationship with all things. We do give thanks this morning for the circumstances of our lives that brought us here. We give thanks for a new awareness of life and ourselves that can come to us in this short hour. We give thanks, Lord, for your blessing upon every member of this congregation, for our friends and our guests who have come to worship and study with us. We give thanks and give our blessing to all people who lift up their minds and hearts to something greater than their own awareness. And this morning we pray for more peace, more love, more joy in this world. And we pray, O Lord Christ, indwelling. Let there be peace and love and joy in this world, and let it begin with me right now. Amen. Before we share our lesson together, this morning I have in my hand a check. It was given to me by a wonderful group in the congregation. They're a group of ladies. Most of them are not only senior members here in the congregation, but they're senior citizens. And they have what they call the Arts and the Crafts Club. And once a week they come over here and they have a room and they make doilies and all kinds of fancy things. And many of times, you know, they're for sale. Well, the other day, Dottie Simpson, who's their chairperson, came in and gave me a check for $300. And as I looked at the check, I thought, that's an awful lot of doilies, you know, to crochet and make. And I think it's wonderful that they do this. They come and eat their lunch here and share together in friendship, and they have a lot of fun, and they do make a lot of things. And let's give them a hand in this congregation. And continue making those dollies, doilies, and whatever you do. It's all of us together, you know, that make a group family situation. And as you know, the Caring and Sharing program, this morning at the first service was a lady who couldn't have ever been able to get here unless through that program someone brought her this one time. And she was just overjoyed. And as I see the things that go on in this great family, I marvel not only at what we're doing, but the opportunities we are creating and the possibilities that are continually showing up for us to do. Because it isn't just to build great buildings and create an organization that churches are formed. They are living organisms of people working together as best they can. And this is what makes a gathering and a group. Now our lesson today is on the idea of non-resistance. And I've taken most of the things from the last chapter of the book of the same name by Amelia Shanklin. And I want to read you just quickly some of the things in this chapter. I won't identify where they are. Many of you are reading this book at the same time we have been having this lesson, and you undoubtedly will recognize these things. It says, non-resistance is stronger than resistance. Its practice requires more mind capacity than is required for resistance.
Its appeal is to the divine thing in you. Now, some people get turned off by the words divine and God, but divine, the word divine and the word God, these have wonderful meanings. But we could say, rather than divine, the non-material part of you. It is the essence of God. In other words, non-resistance allows us to be aware of the reality of ourselves. It goes on to say, resistance means to oppose by inertness or active force, physically or mentally. You mentally resist more than you physically resist. Many of us think that we're very non-resistant, but most of us know how to physically be non-resistant. But when it comes to the mental part of it, it's very difficult. I remember at the height of the anti-war demonstrations, and many of our young people, and rightly so, were very indignant, and they were very idealistic, and they didn't quite understand what non-resistance meant. And I know I was in a group, and I listened, and there was a little argument between two of these very non-resistant people. And finally, one of the most non-resistant said, "I can't stand that!" And they were being very non-resistant in outer ways, but inside they were resisting with all their might. Sometimes non-resistance is a cover-up. It's a cover-up for those who are filled with hostility and don't want to face it themselves, nor to project it to other people. So we have to be very careful about our non-resistance. I think you can be non-resistant and in a case march off to war. Now that seems almost contrary, or it seems like there must be a contradiction or a hypocrisy somewhere, but it depends on what's going on within you. Many of us have been in war zones, and we have seen the person who was absolutely overjoyed to get to kill someone, but we've also seen people who didn't want any part of it, but were doing it because they felt that they were caught up in it, and it was a duty. It's a very intricate thing. I have signed myself many letters of young men who didn't want to fight, who wanted to be conscientious objectors. And I have written letters to many who were on front lines. And I have no feeling. I feel it depends on the individual and how you feel about it. Myself, I'm very grateful for this country. And I am grateful not only for the country that I would be willing to defend, but I'm grateful for people who have strong ideas and who have very idealistic purposes, because I think it's in all of these ideas that make this country great. And if we stop anyone from having their ideas, then the country isn't going to be what it is today. Even though sometimes we seem to be on a mass binge to criticize ourselves, and I think the problem is there's only a few criticizing, and they're very articulate. And what they're criticizing is so minute compared to the tremendousness of this country that we should, the rest of us, not lose our balance. But it goes on to say, hurts, wounds are produced by resistance. It always takes at least two to make a quarrel. If you resist in any way, you make yourself a candidate for bruises, for buffetings, for postponements. The things that you meet in life do not hurt you. They are powerless to affect you, but your reaction to them may hurt you. If you resist by active opposition, you most certainly will be hurt, even though you be acclaimed the victor. You will be scarred by the wounds of the contest. You will be hurt to the measure of the hurt that you would bestow. It goes on to say, carrying the teachings to a practical application, you may wish to ask in regard to physical oppositions, suppose that I am in an unfamiliar territory. It is pitch dark, and I run into a stone wall and am hurt. Why am I hurt? The obvious answer to the question is, the physical opposition of your body to the physical opposition of the stone wall produces the hurt. But there are other oppositions more potent than those. The impact of your body against the wall sets into action a sequence of thoughts, all of which may be resistant. Your mind flares in resistance resentment against the darkness, the strangeness, the complement of circumstances that brought the collision about. Also, your instinctive thought is, the wall is hard, of course I shall be hurt. Resisting the teachings of non-resistance, you ask, am I to dissolve my body in order that I may not resist the wall? Or should I dissolve the wall in order that I may not resist, it may not resist my body? The nature of your mental reactions on striking the wall causes you to hurt. Have you ever had the experience when you were in a certain state of mind and you were doing something that you weren't thinking completely about and you hit your shin against the side of the bedpost and you felt like, I hope I die. It would be better for it to fall off than for me to go on like this. And you felt very upset and mad. Have you ever been in a joyous occasion where some loved one in a great state of happiness made a mistake and stepped on your little corn, the one on your little toe? And you were in such a happy state and the consciousness around you was so wonderful. And they drew back in great fear of what might happen. And you said, oh, that's all right. It doesn't hurt. And it didn't. Because it depends upon your state of mind. I've seen people die with cancer. But they didn't die from cancer. They died from the fear that so controlled their body and so shut down the healing process in their body that the treatment they received from medical science or the tremendous response of their body to disease could not work properly. And thereby they died, not from cancer, but from the resistance of attitudes that wouldn't allow them to be receptive to the healing process of medical science or the process of the renewal of their body or the spiritual non-material awarenesses that could come into their minds. And therefore, they were so resistant that they died. Resistance can become a habit. Rigidity is a habit of mind that we build within ourselves. I suppose to the degree that we are egocentric, to the degree that we feel separate, because it is the ego that builds the fence around us to protect us, but that same fence encloses us. We spend our lives building bridges. We build bridges so that we can escape. We build bridges of friendship. We build bridges of material gain, bridges of success, bridges of marriage, bridges of all kinds. But those bridges, though they are good, if they are built for the wrong reasons, nothing good will happen. You can do wonderful things for wrong reasons and get bad results. You can give your first-rate causes to second-rate situations and come out a loser and all the time wonder why. Because of the rigidity in being unable to change. We said, for instance, in a great prayer, a prayer to change our minds, a prayer to open our minds, Thy kingdom come, which is the kingdom of the real, the reality of life, to come and we recognize it for what it is. But if we are rigid, we will never be receptive. In other words, it's very difficult to be rigid on certain things and receptive. You are either a receptive person or you are a resistant person. We say for so often, I love you, I love you, I don't love anybody else, but I love you. And what I feel is, if we love one person, we are obligated to love everyone, because love is an awareness of our oneness. And when we love, love has many splendid definitions, but the basic definition of love in the Christian philosophy is oneness. When you say, I love you, it means I'm at one with you. But if you are at one with one person, you are at one with all people. Mostly we say, I love you, which means I need you. Now that's legitimate and good. But don't play like your needs represent your love. Love is the greatest thing in the world. It is the highest mark of living and experiencing. And most of us in the semantics of our speaking, we confuse ourselves and oftentimes the people around us. It's good to need people. It's good to be needed. But that isn't love. That may be the beginnings of it. But oftentimes it can be selfish. Oftentimes it can be very egotistical. If you love me, you will do what I say. No. We don't mean that. What we really mean, if you really need me, and I think you do, you better do what I say. And here's $5. So we have to face ourselves. That's why I think we sometimes get so disappointed, because we're saying one thing and doing another. We're using these beautiful words in life, but we are not letting those words come into their real effect within ourselves. And don't feel bad. All of us do this. The only reason I know how to talk about it is because I've been thinking about it within myself. And this is a universal problem of mankind. I think if there's a second universal problem, it comes to do with Christianity and our understanding of it. Jesus said so many wonderful things. They're so wonderful, we say they couldn't be true. We actually say they're too good to be true. He said in the preface to the greatest sermon ever given, and this is part of our Masterpieces of the Bible series of the next month, but in the Beatitudes, in other words, in the blessed sayings, he said, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And if that didn't do the trick, he goes down two lines and he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now he's talking about the earth and he's talking about the kingdom of heaven. And what's he really saying? Well, as you well know, as I said a moment ago, we are in another culture than Jesus was in. He was in a very oriental culture, in a culture of storytelling, culture of parables. And we've taken this Christianity, this tremendous view of truth, and we have put it in our kind of culture. And if it didn't fit, we kind of worked it around a little. We've made it a very outward kind of religion. We've made it a group insurance plan. Pay your dues and you're under the red umbrella. You know, this sort of thing. Well, I wish I could get you to believe that, but I don't believe it myself. I'm sure the dues would go way up around here if that were the case. But this isn't what life is. We find that Christianity is an individual philosophy. It is not a group philosophy. We've come to practice it in churches and say, you belong, and everybody says, I do. You believe that? I do. Well, you're in. But it isn't that kind of thing at all. It's a very individual philosophy. And Jesus is not talking about outer things. You know, he talks about goats and sheep and shepherds, but he's not talking about that at all. He's talking about attitudes of mind. Now, I know in our culture, in the Occidental and the Western, we've literalized it. We said, if that's what he said, that's what he meant. But that isn't the case at all. So he said, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. What kind of meekness is this? The kind that makes you a rug that everyone walks over and wipes their feet on, and you develop sort of a masochistic attitude of mind. You say, oh, I love it, I love it. Hit me again, hit me again. Some people think that. They say, oh, it's good to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. And we all know we're righteous, don't we? You know, this story. We're right. That's ridiculous. And that isn't what he's talking about at all. He's talking about attitudes of mind. He's not talking about groups of people and what you believe, and if people kick you, that's good. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. This meekness means a meekness of ego. Now, the ego is good, and you don't want to destroy it, but you don't want to be its master. You want it to be your master. You don't want the who are you to govern you. You don't want your outer self-image to dictate to you. You want the what are you. the real part of you, the potential to govern you. So when we read, blessed are the meek, it means blessed are those who can be still and quiet. Blessed are those who don't have to defend themselves. Blessed are those who are not defensive. When somebody tells the truth about you, they say to you, you know, I wish you'd shut up, you talk too much. And if it's true, what do? You say, you're right. Because you see benefit. Now, someone comes to you and they tell you an absolute lie about yourself. They say, the trouble with you bank robbers is that you kill people. And you are a bank robber. And you say, ha ha, that's not true. And it doesn't bother you at all. But what really runs us up the wall is when somebody takes a little truth and a little lie and weaves it together and throws it at you. Then you say, that's not true, and I want the world to know it. And of course, if you really know how to make people mad, you never tell them the truth about themselves, and you never tell them a complete lie. You mix it up a little and throw it at them. You say, the trouble with you is that Mrs. Smith said you talk too much. And then you respond. Or they say, the trouble with you is, if you could get away with it, you'd be a bank robber. Sounds like we have a few bank robbers. And it makes us mad. Now, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. What does it mean, meek? It means to be receptive in the original Aramaic. It means to be receptive. It says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. That's the outer things. If you're receptive, you can have it. If you're receptive, you can have it. He goes on, he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now he's not talking about the material things. He's talking about the invisible part of life. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Again, blessed are those that are receptive. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It's the realm of ideas, the realm of reality. You can have it. It's all yours to the degree that you have the ability to receive. That's all life is. Somebody comes in and they say to me, Reverend Stevens, I'm so lonely, I don't know what I'm going to do. That hasn't anything to do with anyone except them. How receptive are you to friendship? How receptive are you to love? You can understand that. How receptive are you to abundance? How receptive are you to beauty? You see, when we change the pitch, when we change the view, you can see you are exactly what you are receptive to. Some people come into me, they say, the world's going to the dogs, everything's terrible, all people are crook, politicians are all dishonest, the currency's terrible, the country's going to rack and ruin. The potential is always there, but the potential for the other side of the story to come true is there too. We say, you know, we talk about life. We should never talk about life. We should talk about our awareness of life, because life is exactly what we are. When we say, I hate you, that's not true. I hate my you. When I talk about the world, I'm talking about my world. I'm talking about the state of consciousness that's in that little plastic bag that I am, and I can't escape. When I say I love you, I love my you. It all comes down to my consciousness and my awareness. This is the mystic view of life. If I want to change the world, what do? Go out here and shoot all the people that don't agree with me? No, I change my concept of them. I become less rigid and I open my mind to new ideas. I change my world in this way. This is the only way I can change my world, according to my opinion of life. There are four attitudes that we can take about life. I think most of us are a combination of these attitudes, and maybe we're not sure just which one is right. The first one is, if he hurts me, I will hurt him more. This is vindictiveness. Now, the second attitude is, if he hurts me, I will treat him the same. This is retribution. The third one is, if he hurts me, I will ignore him and have nothing more to do with him. This is disdain. Number four, if he hurts me, I will love him. and serve Him. Now that one you say, well, I've heard that before. I don't know about the other three, but I don't know about that last one either. Jesus said, if somebody slaps you on the cheek, turn your other cheek. Let them hit you again. Now, He wasn't talking about cheeks. He was talking about mental attitudes. He said right after that, if somebody asked you to go a mile, go two. Now, the people who were listening to Him knew what He was talking about, because at that time, the Roman Empire had conquered this rocky little place called Palestine, which nobody wanted to go and serve in as far as a professional Roman soldier. But there was a rule all over the Roman Empire that if a soldier could find someone who wasn't a Roman citizen, any one of these conquered people, and he was going along and their sword was heavy and their great shield was heavy, or the whatever they were carrying, their little knapsack, ditty bag, whatever, I don't know. But it was said that if you could find someone and ask them, they had to carry that a mile. And so you can imagine some little Jewish person running along on his errands, and some soldier, Roman soldier, said, hey, you come over here. Pick up that and carry it a mile for me. Now, he may have been going just the other way than our friend, the little Jewish fellow, was going, but the Jewish fellow had to pick up the thing and carry it a mile. Can't you imagine as he carried that with all the mutterings under his breath, I hate this fellow, I don't like this, a heavy load, I'm going to be late. Jesus said it would be better to carry it 2 miles than to be in that state of mind. He said it would be better to go an extra mile. Why did He say this? If you look at His teachings and if you try to think in a different way than the way you may have been brought up, you'll find out that Jesus said something else to someone. He said, what good does it do to love those that already love you? And then He made one of these absurd statements. He said, love your enemies. Do good to them that despitefully use you. Now, I know that's been misinterpreted. And that's where we get all this self-righteousness that's generated in the Christian religion. But if we understand His attitude of mind and the teaching He's trying to give us, which is so foreign to us, we find out He's really saying, it's not what you're supposed to do in life that give you the tremendous awareness of what life is. It's when you go beyond and do the extra. Now, it isn't virtuous to do the extra. And sometimes we let our awareness, our outer awareness, become very virtuous. And that's when we start doing good things for wrong reasons. And then all kinds of ridiculous experiences happen to us, which usually discourages. No, Jesus said, you are supposed to do certain things. In marriage, you're supposed to do certain things. In raising your children and your relation to them, there's supposed to be certain things. But He said, as I understand it, life really gets exciting only when you go beyond. And you do it for good reasons, for the joy of doing it. Now, a person who's resistive has a very difficult time even doing what they're supposed to do. A person who is resistive and rigid is very careful to measure. You love me? I love you. How much do you love me? I love you that much. Want to go a little further? No? Okay. We'll keep it right there. What fun is that? That's no fun. But this is the way sometimes in our mentality, well, I watered the lawn last night, you water it tonight, you know, this sort of thing. Or I've cooked dinner for 8 days in a row, can't we go eat somewhere out, you know, all this stuff. Then you begin to get these things of, I'm only a maid around here, everybody just uses me, nobody loves me. Or the other one that says, well, all you want's my paycheck. Nobody respects me. Nobody pays any attention to me. That's what happens when we start getting rigid with what we're doing. And love, oneness, joy, excitement goes right out the window. You know, it's not hard to enjoy life when you're living But many of us die at 30, and somebody like me comes along and officiates even when you're 90. But you've been dead a long time because you haven't added any new growth. You've made it a practice, almost a practice, not to go beyond what you're supposed to do. And you've missed the great livingness of life. Oh, there's so much I would like to read to you here. It says, mental resistance is the act of receiving hurt. Mental non-resistance is the act of refusing to be hurt. Sometimes we say to people, oh, you don't know how you've wounded me. You don't know how you've hurt me. That's not going to hurt them. Not really. It hurts you. Don't allow anyone to hurt you. Sometimes we almost get a satisfaction by saying, oh, they hurt me. It went right to the quick. Well, it did, undoubtedly, because we allowed it. And somehow, in our twisted awareness, we have thought, if it really hurts me bad enough, it's going to pain them. And maybe if they're uneducated enough to think that, it will hurt them too. But what good has been resolved in this? We should say to people, you can't hurt me, no one can. Not unless I give my permission to be hurt. In any warfare in which you find yourself engaged, you are the one who wars and the one who is warred against. You war against your own thoughts of nature, of people, of life. The universe is at peace. Your skirmishers are on the surface. They do not reach into the heart of life. If you think that you hate others, you hate merely what your imperfect vision claims to see in others. If you distrust others, your distrust is proof that you doubt the integrity of the universe. I once heard a very fine man say, when somebody says, can you trust him about another? And it was to do with a great sum of money. And this man said, well, I don't know. But it would be worth $10,000 to find out. And I questioned him about that, and he said it would be worth $1,000,000. I would give $1,000,000 to be sure of just who I could trust. And I think there's great meaning in that. Sometimes we won't even let ourselves be put in a position to be hurt because we won't trust someone. If we've been disappointed in a great love and we're hurt, we say, I'll never love again. A few months ago, a little lady who'd had a dog who was her sole companion for many years, the little dog had to be put to sleep. And her first thought was, I'll never have another pet. She's changed her mind. Has two dogs now. We all have these thoughts in us. We all say, I'll never be hurt again. No one can hurt you unless you agree. No one can hurt you unless you think it's virtuous to be hurt. No one can hurt you unless you think your revenge will be to the other person letting yourself be hurt. And all of this is in that willful ego that makes us so rigid in life. Well, there's one other thing, maybe a couple here. It says, if you consider yourself poor, and if you also resist the poverty that you have brought into your life, you will have trouble, you will have double work in winning your supply. You will have to dismiss the consciousness of poverty, and you will have to become non-resistant to supply. So long as you treat poverty as an unavoidable experience, poverty will thrust its gaunt form before your eyes, and you will be in rags. It says supply is a part of the universe. You are a part of the universe. The unity that prevails in the universe makes you and supply one. In other words, in our rigidity, we only isolate ourselves. Now, we can be very rigid about certain things, but that rigidity will carry over into all parts of our consciousness. You can stand up for what's right, without feeling resentful about it. You can have your morals, you can have your ethics, you can take care of your responsibilities, you can do what you believe is right. And no one can keep you from it. No one. If you can, what? Be non-resistant. You can speak in love, and you can love your enemy. There's no reason why any of us can't do this except to retrain ourselves. There is one last thing here. It reads, "Do not resist ridicule of your confidence. One who does not accept with God all things are possible resists omnipotence. Do not resist the one's resistance. God does not need your defense. Your defense of yourself weakens you by disintegrating your moral structure. One speaking from the who consciousness may ask you, someone who's living just in the outer, who hasn't discovered this inner awareness, one who's living just out here may say, so you really believe that nothing is impossible with God? And speaking you from the what are you consciousness, the inner awareness, might say, yes, I believe that all things are possible with reality. You mean your oneness, your state of oneness with reality? And the questioner then thinks that he has you in a corner, and he says, can God make a 2-year-old tree in a minute of time? Can God make a 2-year-old tree in a minute of time? And your answer is yes. And he can do it even better than that. For God does not work with time, but with eternity. Where his works have been completed from the beginning. God's 2-year-old tree is already made. Always has been. But with your present focus on life, it will take you 2 years to see it. Life is very delicate. And it depends upon where you stand, not on some material stairway. But life has to do with where you are in consciousness and in awareness. That's what your world is. You only fight yourself. You only hate or love yourself. You only war against yourself, or you only have peace within yourself. And what happens to the world around you and others is simply what's going on in you with yourself. Are you a loving person inside? Are you a forgiving person? Are you a non-resistant person? Do you love yourself? Are you a good neighbor to yourself? Are you honest with yourself? Are you humble and teachable with yourself? To all those things you will be to the people around you. But first, it has to be in you. Now let us be still a moment and give thanks that we have ears to hear and hearts to understand. Let us give thanks that today we have taken another step toward that which is truly real and that which is truly us. This we pray in the nature of Jesus Christ. Amen.